we are going to open a work session on House Bill 5021, the Department of Higher Education Operations Bill. I'll open that work session. You should have in front of you, members, a daily agenda, which is a little bit different format that we've been seeing. But, Mr. Bender, can you step us through what we can, what we're going to try to accomplish today?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members. If you do look at this daily agenda, I do apologize. We were a little disrupted by the calculation of the building yesterday, and things aren't in order as they usually are. But this is a plan for today's work session for you. And you can see we have a number of items there that either LFO staff or OUS staff are prepared to address, starting with a report back from Oregon State University on their on the situation in the Extension Service budget. Then their OUS staff prepared a report that you should have in front of you with additional information on fee remission programs. Then we're going to hear about the status of the proposed method to address vacancy savings. As you recall, we looked at a LFO proposal and asked for additional information about that to see whether that was something that you wanted to adopt or wanted to modify. So we'll provide you some status report on what's going on in that area. And then some additional items that were on the memo that was distributed to you yesterday that we were going through. I do hope all of you still have that with you. If any of you do not have yesterday's memo, please let us know, and we'll get a copy for you before we get to this point in the agenda. But discussion of compensation increases, some other items there going down. Then there would be subcommittee approval or modification of OUS performance measures. Those were also included in the memo distributed yesterday. There's a proposed budget note you'll be asked to consider relating to administration. And finally, if time permits, there will be a review, a very high-level review of how the resource allocation model typically works and the modifications that OUS is planning to implement in the 0305 biennium.
The members, too, I might just add that we are now seriously behind our schedule, and so it looks like we will be meeting tomorrow morning, depending on the progress that we make today. But we'll kind of make that judgment at the end of this meeting about whether we will meet tomorrow, and previously we had scheduled not to meet. But I would also like the record to reflect that Representative Bates is excused today. And with that, could we have President White and Lila Hovland come forward and talk to us about the Extension Service budget at Oregon State University. Committee members, please feel free to ask questions anytime. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr.
Excuse me. I just wanted to mention to the committee before you began that you have had distributed to you a letter. It was actually addressed to me, but these are copies are to you from President White.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Morgan, I'm Lila Hoglum, the Dean and Director of the Extension Service at Oregon State University. I understand that there were a number of questions that came up yesterday about the Extension Service budget. There were three questions in particular that were passed on to me, and let me just mention those, and then if you want to go a different direction, that would be great. I understand that there are questions about the technical adjustment and the $2.5 million for extension, what that is, where that came from. Also, understand that there was some conversation around stakeholder input and how we are going about making decisions about reductions with extension. And then third, I understand that there were questions about institutional controls to monitor budgets within Oregon State University. So if those are the major questions, would you like me to just start out with those?
Well, I think, too, that the committee members expressed an interest in kind of a chronology of how events unfolded here that bring us to where we are right now.
Okay.
Any other things that you want to hear about, Representative Mark?
Yes, the one question I had was, what is the current FTE and the 32 reduction, what's that come from? Does that come from the 500 proposed or the 450 supposedly current? Or
anything else, committee members, to add? I'm sure that as your presentation unfolds, if the committee members do have questions, that we'll freely interrupt you.
Okay.
Please proceed.
That's fine. And I will try to weave in responses to those questions also as we go. Let me start with the technical adjustment. The technical adjustment that you have in front of you for $2.5 million came as a result of a meeting that was called by Steve Bender and Bill McGee. This was a meeting that was held in February, and it was a request by those two folks for each of the statewide service public service directors to meet with them to review our budgets, to explain how we had taken the reductions that we'd taken during the current biennium and what the impact of those reductions were, and also to explain how we were anticipating additional reductions as we moved into the next biennium. As a result of those conversations, one of the things that I did was went through the reductions that Extension had taken during this biennium, and in that conversation I indicated to Mr. Bender and Mr. McGee that we had used about $2.5 million of federal fund balances to help balance our budget during this biennium, and that decision had been made about a year ago by my cabinet, by me and my cabinet, in order to get through this biennium's budget reductions. So when we had that conversation, Mr. McGee then asked if that $2.5 million was one-time only funds or if it was ongoing funds. I indicated that it was one-time only funds because it was fund balances in our federal accounts, and he then subsequently asked if we were reducing our other funds limitation request by $2.5 million, since that $2.5 million would not be there for use during the next biennium. We had not done that, and so he asked OUS to make a technical adjustment in the budgets to reflect that $2.5 million reduction in other funds limitation. And so that's what that is it's simply a reduction in other funds limitation as a result of spending federal funds, fund balances that will not be there in the future. Those were fund balances that we used once. Once we use them, they're gone. And so it's simply a technical adjustment in our budget to reflect that $2.5 million that we used will not be there in the future.
Are there any questions on this issue? Please proceed.
Then let me go then to the 32 FTE and try to address that question as well, Representative March. The 32.81 FTE that's reflected here is related to that $2.5 million, and that is a reduction in FTE that we have begun to plan for as we look at the next biennial budget. Because we use $2.5 million of federal fund balance to help balance our budget during this biennium, we didn't reduce those FTE during this biennium. That means that as we plan for the 03-05 biennium, we will need to take that reduction in the 03-05 biennium. And so that's what the 32.81
And FTE that's from are. Your current FTE of 450.
That is from our current FTE. As I understand the FTE figures that you have here, the 503 figure should have been reflected in the let me think about how this happened. When our legislative budget was adopted in 01-03, it was at 550 FTE. We then requested 450 FTE. We, during this biennium, requested an increase in other funds limitation because of an increase in county dollars that had come and an anticipated increase in federal resources that we expected as a result of Homeland Security, as a result of some e-commerce projects that we were involved in, and also in order to spend the fund balances in our federal account.
This sounds counterintuitive, though.
Thank
you. You said you used the fund balance to fund current FTE, but now you're saying you're using the fund balance to do increased FTE.
That was only one small part of the increase in other funds limitation. The other funds limitation that was increased at a special during the emergency board session during this biennium came with an additional 50 FTE. That additional 50 FTE was identified simply based on average salary rates and the average salary rate that corresponded to the additional $5 million of requested spending limitation in other funds limitation. It doesn't show up until the 03-05 biennium. The increase in FTE doesn't show up until the 03-05 biennium. I'm not certain why it doesn't show up until then.
Steve, do you have a reason why that 50 doesn't show up under the legislative approved?
I'm double-checking, Representative. I do, of course, recall the emergency board item that the dean is referring to. I'm trying to see if I have information on whether there was actually an increase in FTE that was approved then. If there was not the increase in FTE, it would not show up in legislatively adopted. If you could, one second, please.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to find those records overnight. I'm sorry. So.
And then when Mr. Bender gets the information, we can come back to this point.
And so
we have BAM now here. Do you have any information that you could add to this?
Madam Chair, I think maybe the timing, Bill McGee from Department of Administrative Services.
Thank you.
The timing was in the third special session, I believe, when this occurred.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that given the technical nature of how the budget is prepared, that may be the reason why you're not seeing this turn up until we rolled that third special session action forward in the governor's budget. Steve's checking, may have better records than I do right here, but I think that may be part of the explanation.
Okay. So the bottom line is that we're technically approved for 503 currently. Okay. So this isn't an increase from... Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And so does that take care then of the 32?
So now you're in the position of having to ratchet back 32 out of the 450. Out of the 503.
That's correct.
Okay, I was trying to find out where we were subtracting, what number we were subtracting from.
Yes, yes. Okay.
Senator Masurly.
I think we're making progress, but I'm still a little confused. I read through your response that we received today, you're talking 29.6 FTE. Am I looking at oranges and apples or on page 2?
Yes.
President White.
That refers to the orange of the current biennium, and the conversation here is for the next biennium, which is the apple, where it's a total of 49.5, of which this 32 is part of that 49.5.
And President White, for the record, could you identify yourself, please?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm Tim White, President of Oregon State University.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I follow up? Well, then as I go down to the solution for 03-05, we're talking 49 with a possible addition 20. Or maybe I'm getting ahead of your presentation.
No, that's okay. In fact, you're helping me move on.
Okay.
And I think that the question here was, first of all, where are we really starting out, which appears to be 503?
That is correct.
And then what we need to know is how we're going to get to the end result that's going to right-size your employees to your revenue.
Yes. Okay, let me go there next. We have, as we began budget planning to, as we looked forward to the 03-05 biennium, it was clear to us that we were going to have to take some additional reductions. And we began that budget planning with the governor's budget that was originally proposed in January. And as a result of that, that indicated to us that we were going to have to reduce about an additional 49 FTE. Because of that, we began to implement a process whereby we sought input from a number of constituents across the state of Oregon. And so in March, we went through a process where our county extension staff chairs sought input from constituency across the state of Oregon to find out what the highest priority needs and issues were. Now, this process is something that I call a needs-based process as we look at how we're going to allocate the resources for the OSU Extension Service. Some would call it a zero-based budgeting approach. Nonetheless, either way, we went back to the people of Oregon and our constituents and asked what the highest priority needs were. We had, I think it was 1,199 people who participated in that process of identifying highest priority needs across the state of Oregon. We then brought those needs to a meeting where our extension staff chairs took a look at those needs and looked at an FTE level that we gave them, the reduced FTE level that we gave them, and then asked them to identify how they would employ that FTE level based on the highest priority needs that were identified by their constituents. They did that. And then we had our campus-based department heads and program leaders do the same thing with our campus-based faculty. Once we did that, we put together a draft staffing plan for the Extension Service that was based on the highest priority needs as identified by the people. That staffing plan then was put back out for constituents to respond to and for our faculty and staff to respond to. At that point, we had over 1,400 responses from constituents. We had our faculty and staff from nearly every county respond, and we had, I believe it was 16 departments on campus respond to the draft proposed staffing plan. At the same time, President White asked us to prepare several levels of staffing, and so we ended up with four different levels of potential staffing based on, again, potential or projected revenue for the next biennium. We have looked at the responses that we got back from constituents and from our faculty and staff. We have relooked at the plan, made some minor adjustments in the plan based on those responses, and last week then President White went through all of that information, including information from our faculty senate, and made a decision to at least initially begin implementation of one of those staffing levels. That staffing level is described, I believe, in the piece that you are referring to, Senator Messerly, which talks about 49.5 FTE reduction. That's the FTE reduction level that President White asked us to initially implement until we get a final budget from the legislature. At the time at which we get a final budget from the legislature, we will then modify our reduction level based on that.
Questions or comments? Representative March,
yes, is that 49 from the 500?
Yes.
40, okay, so the 29.6 or 32 reduction is from the 500, the 49 is from the 500.
Yes, there are three different numbers that you have in front of you. The 29.6 is the number of FTE that we reduced during this current biennium. Okay, it's not a part of the 2.5 million. It's what we reduced in this current biennium. Okay, the 2.5 million is the amount of our budget reductions that we took on fund balances, federal fund balances, just to help us balance this biennium's budget. So we need to move, that's an additional 32 FTE that we talked about earlier. And in addition to that, in order to accommodate increased expenditures and additional reductions, we will need to reduce up to, well, I don't know up to what, but at this point in time, we have developed plans for reducing up to 49.5 FTE. The 32 is a part of that 49.5. The 29.6 is what's already been reduced. It's already gone.
And then one follow-up. The in a worst-case scenario, that number could increase by an addition 20, i.e., you could wind up at 69 down instead of 49 down.
That is exactly right.
Okay.
Yes.
When you're increasing a negative, it's difficult to read in a sentence.
Agree.
Thank you.
Agree. Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Messick.
So just so I can keep this clear in my mind,
mm-hmm.
you started with an approved 503 FTE. You've reduced that a total of 79.1, which will leave you 423.9 FTE, is that right? With the potential for 20 more.
I believe that is correct, yes.
How are you prioritizing those reductions?
Yes. The reductions are prioritized based on what the people identified as their highest priority needs. And so that was a part of the process that we went through in March in meeting with local constituents, and in some cases that included our local extension advisory committees. In some cases that included county commissioners. In some cases that included focus groups of constituencies in communities. I had a statewide stakeholder group meeting in which I sought input from sort of representatives of statewide groups that might not be represented in county groups. And so all of that information was collected and brought together to make initial staffing recommendations.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Thank you. The concern I have is that you're stating here that the reductions, and maybe this isn't counting the 79, but will be through attrition and vacancy positions. That tells me that some of your base programs, for your older staff, will be reduced substantially, or potentially could be. And not to say that the new initiatives that you've included in your expansion aren't important as well. But could we see an imbalance coming here that some of the old programs are going to be substantially understaffed? Some of the newer programs will be maintained?
Senator Mezzalia, that's a very good question. It's a very important question. What you see represented in this piece is the way we balance the budget during this current biennium. During this current biennium, we primarily used vacancies in order to balance the budget. In the plans that we prepared, as we look to the 2003-2005 budget, we are not paying attention to where vacancies exist because of attrition. In my opinion, attrition is a useful tool for balancing budgets in the short run. But it's not a useful tool in the long run because you can't predict vacancies based on priorities. And so what we've done is we've stepped back at this point and engaged this needs-based process in order to identify the highest priority needs and to assign FTE to those needs rather than looking at vacancies as we look to the 2003-2005 biennium.
Madam Chair. Senator Gordley. Thank you. I could follow up. You made some investments using reserves. Do those investments match up with the priorities identified in the needs-based process? For example, the new initiatives that Senator Messerly was referring to, the new initiatives as we see them spelled out on page 2 of President White's document include business and information technology, public issues education, outreach to minority families, water quality. Where did each of those items wind up in the needs assessment?
They absolutely were identified as important issues, high priority issues, as we continue to look at how we staff for the future. And so I'm trying to remember off the top of my head what the five major themes were that came out of the issues identification. One of them I know was economic development and diversification. And so that would, the information, the Business and Information Technology Initiative is clearly a part of that. Another one was helping, I'm not going to get the language exactly right here, but essentially supporting the development of youth. We have a huge outreach to minority families program going on with our 4-H Youth Development Program. And the 4-H Youth Development Program came in as a very high priority. Trying to remember others. One had to do with environmental sustainability, environmental and economic sustainability. Our water quality education programs would clearly be a part of that. And so there is a very clear parallel between where we were making initial investments and some of the priorities that came to the table when we looked at issues. Okay. Yes.
Representative March.
Just one clarification, because I thought I had it down until Senator Messerly asked the staffing level reduction question. The 49 F reduction, does that include the 32 or not include the 32?
It does include the 32, but it does not include the 29.
The 29 that's already, okay.
That's correct.
Ah.
The numbers are close. That's why I wanted that clarification.
Well, that's,
I can understand
your
confusion.
And then a follow-up to that is you used fund balances to cover the budget out of balance, mm-hmm. and also the attrition and vacant positions to cover budget problems.
That is correct.
Okay. I think that signals to me that President White has a great job ahead of him in tightening down on fiscal spending and making sure people are working within budgets, because that would indicate to me probably, you are off by $4.5 million, for a biennium?
The reduction that we took during this biennium was about, that is correct, it's about $6 million, actually, was the total reduction that we took during this biennium. And that, I think, is a good segue into, I think, the additional question that was asked before, and that has to do with institutional controls and institutional policies. And if this is an appropriate time, I'd like to defer to President
Lila,
White
just
for that.
Just for clarification, if
yes.
you could you talk to the committee about where the, I know that you attempted to take the lion's share of the position cuts on campus and hold the field services as whole as you could. Can you talk a little bit about the split in the cuts, where they fall?
Yes. When we looked at, we try to pay very close attention to our on and off campus ratio. In terms of our faculty numbers. And right now, we are at about 60% of our faculty are located off campus in our county offices, and about 40% are located on campus. That, to me, seemed like it was a bit high on campus. Although, when you look across the country, it's a bit on the high side, but it's not far off. As we began to look at reductions, I was very concerned that we do absolutely everything we possibly could to assure direct program delivery to people in communities across the state. As a result of that, one of the first things that my cabinet and I talked about was the possibility of adjusting the ratio of on to off campus faculty in order to assure that more faculty remained off campus in our field county field offices in order to address directly the needs of people across the state of Oregon. And so we made a conscious decision at the very beginning of this process to change that ratio and increase the number of off-campus faculty in the ratio. It is now closer to we made a conscious decision to go two-thirds, one-third. As we identified needs, highest priority needs, that ratio actually shifted slightly more to the counties. And so the ratio has increased or the part of the ratio that's off campus has increased compared to the proportion that's on campus. Did I get that right? The off-campus has increased. And that was primarily done, again, to make sure that we had a maximum number of people who were located in our field offices who could deal directly with issues that were important to the people across the state.
Okay. Does everyone have a clear picture now of why the staffing reductions are at the level that they're at and the fiscal issues that are associated with it? Senator Mazur.
I think so, Madam Chair, except your ratio right now then is two-thirds, one-third?
It's actually a little greater than that. I have that information, but it's very close to two-thirds, one-third. Yeah.
Let's discuss the oversight issue.
Okay.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, I'm still Tim White, president of Oregon State University for the record, and would like to speak to a couple things about our controls. First of all, in 2001 and 2002, we made several changes in our budget and finance group, including a change of senior leadership in terms of the vice presidency, in terms of hiring a new director of budgets who has arrived just in the last 3 or 4 months as a net new FTE for us in terms of our oversights. Part of the difficulty here in that clarity of 2020 hindsight is that the federal balances that were in federal accounts were not visible to our centralized accounting system. They weren't in Banner until such times that a request is made on those accounts to bring them to Oregon State University. Then they entered into the Banner system and expenditures were monitored. We have now instituted for all our federal accounts a monthly evaluation of what that account is. So if an account is growing or shrinking in a way that is not historical or disproportionate to our expectations, it gives an early analysis to dig down and understand why that's happening. Secondly is, and that's done monthly by two separate sets of eyes, one in our budget office and one in our financial reporting group. So two separate independent but related groups are analyzing our federal accounts. Secondly, we do monthly accounts on all the accounts within the university. Again, two separate sets of eyes. We've increased our FTE commitment there and increased our sophistication of our software in order to capture any expenditures over time that are variant from past practice or variant from expected budgets. And so those are, I think, the two or three main things. We had a personnel change of senior leadership. We've appointed a new position for the university, and we've increased surveillance that is on a monthly basis for both federal accounts as well as on-campus accounts. And finally, as I think about this, in the fall, a lot of the uncertainties that we're speaking to today in terms of who actually retires, in terms of the final budget that you good folks are able to allocate, in terms of what the counties are able to continue their commitment with, and in terms of some industries who, quite frankly, are interested in helping support some FTEs that are specific to their needs in some of these counties. Once those uncertainties are resolved in the fall, we'll be able to come back and look at the plan and determine if it's on target or not and make any adjustments in either direction come the fall. And I've also committed that we will call yet for an internal audit in the fall to take a look at the plan, make sure that we're doing it correctly, and also to make sure our business practices are correct around extension. And I think the president of the university needs that level of comfort to be certain that we actually have our arms around this issue with respect to extension. I guess related to that, institutional control is an institutional commitment, Madam Chair, about the importance of extension to Oregon State University and to the state of Oregon. I want to be very clear about that. It is a program that is part of our DNA, both because we want it to be as well as what our charter is as a land-grant institution. And so we're very concerned about any reductions. Even one FTE is a difficult thing to consider, and this scale is difficult for us. As a consequence of that, in the fall, we will be able to determine that glide path, as I said. And what we're aiming for here is to absolutely maintain as many programs for as long as we can so we hit our new budget and manage to that budget. What we are not interested in doing is overcompensating in the short run only to add back, because that sort of withdrawal of programs to the communities only to reinstate them some short time later just seems to be the wrong way to go. But we can't make any commitments to that today because we don't know the budget, and we don't know the institutional budget or its capacity to extend this glide path beyond the upcoming biennium. But know that our commitment and our principle is to look at that and to do whatever we can to maintain these programs and to absolutely minimize the rate of decline in these glide paths. So I think those are the main points that I wish to emphasize, and I'm happy to discuss any of them or others that I didn't.
Questions or comments on the accounting oversight issues? President White and I have talked at some length about the Extension Service, and what we've talked about is that the Extension Service is the public relations piece of Oregon State University out in the communities in the state, and that's the place where the university is most visible off the campuses. And I have reinforced to him the importance of the university maintaining a strong commitment to the program, and there are complicating issues as the system attempts through the means that are available to it to downsize the employees to the cash flow. And part of the problem is with the tenure issues, it requires a lengthy notice time to people. And so most of the actual lowering down of the FTE will have to take place in the second year of the biennium. And it is going to be a challenge to the university to make that be a gradual enough glide pattern in lowering down those FTE so that they don't miss the target. And I'm very gratified with the discussions that we've had over the university's commitment to try to soften the landing for the Extension Service and the recognition in how important the Extension Service is to the universities and to the communities and to the people that it serves. And this is a very difficult situation and one that is going to cause some adjustments to take place both on campus and out in the field. But I'm hoping that as we proceed into this, that there will be, everything will be done that can be done to try to soften the glide pattern and the landing here. Are there any more questions or comments that anyone wishes to make on this issue? Senator Mazzarri.
Madam Chair, I'm feeling comfortable to some degree that the university is really moving forward in the proper in resolving the issues. A question I have probably of the Chancellor's office, however, though, and maybe I should tell you where I'm coming from. I have served as the audit committee chairman for a holding company, a bank holding company, where we had several affiliates, which appears to me to be similar to what the Chancellor's office is over the university. And my question is, based on the experience I've had in dealing with budgets and issues such as this, why has not the Chancellor's office picked up this process? I know 2 years ago we had another incident from the university in which was resolved, and it seems to me that I would assume that there's responsibility of oversight from the Chancellor's office. And I'm curious as to, do we have the adequate process at that level to keep our universities, individual universities, from getting these kind of situations in the future?
Chancellor Jarvis, do you have somebody that you wish to send forward to answer this? President White, if you want to stick around and add to the conversation, that would be great.
Sure. I think I'd like to just say one thing, and then Tom can weigh in as well. Senator Mazzarri, this problem was identified over a year ago, and within 8 weeks we came to a plan that resolved the 01-03 biennium and started the more difficult process for this next biennium. So I think as soon as it was recognized, it was immediately addressed. So that's one thing. Secondly is that the internal audit that I spoke about would be done by Patricia Stumpkowski, who is an OUS internal audit function, and we'll use her to help us gain insights that we actually have it right come the fall once these uncertainties are resolved. But so I wanted to make that point. And secondly, I think it's the it's the level of on-campus oversight as well as the interaction between our university and the chancellor's office that came from the earlier discussions, I guess is a euphemism that I will use, that actually led to the fact that we were able to identify this quickly. And so I think we're actually seeing some of the benefits of those earlier difficulties in terms of what we're doing today. But I'll let Vice Chancellor Anders respond directly to you, please.
Tom Andrews, Oregon University System. Yeah, there's a couple of things that are happening here. First, Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, one of the areas that, frankly, we do not focus on and, frankly, would have a very, very difficult time doing it in great depth is looking at fund balances in federal programs. That would be a tough area for a function that is really trying to maintain as much oversight as possible through general funds, the state general funds, and our tuition and fees. Not that we don't look at that, not that that isn't part of an external audit that takes place annually, and in fact this would have been. This would not have been large enough, though, from an audit standpoint to be material and to be identified in the kinds of external audits that are done by outside firms. What our board's approach is to this right now is, and I think President White mentioned that we'll be working with the university on this particular issue, and we'll be seeking a report that will be reported to the board. Both the controller and the internal audit function will be working with them to be certain that there aren't recurrences. And to the prior issue where you mentioned that a couple of years ago there was a financial concern at Oregon State University, as it turns out, there really wasn't one. And that was part of our role in exploring that. The university had really self-identified a $19 million problem. And as it turned out, following a good deal of review, that didn't exist. So I guess on our behalf, that's not something we did identify and we wouldn't have identified.
Follow-up?
Just a brief follow-up, Madam Chair. I understand how at your level that it... it's very difficult to get to that detail. I guess my question or my concern would be more that your oversight would ensure that there is a process at the university level where they are sure to pick those up.
Madam Chair and Senator Messerly, that's a very good point, and that is a significant part of what my role is. And I think as President White has mentioned, part of the concerns that rose a couple of years ago out of that problem at the university was an identification of a lack of internal control, and part of what our role was in working both with external review function and internally was putting those or beginning to put those controls in place. Unfortunately, in this particular case, those fund balances just preceded that, and the fund balance allocations had just preceded that, so they were kind of caught in the middle. But you're absolutely right. That is a significant part of what we have to do with the system.
At the current time, considering that 2 years ago there was the issue of the fund balances in federal funds accounts addressed, what's the current situation in the oversight that OUS has over this situation with all the campuses and not just OSU?
Madam Chair, we have the same role in all of the campuses. I mean, and one of the things that I think you find is when you identify a particular issue on a campus, you immediately begin to look at all of the other campuses to ensure that you don't have that sort of problem. But there's two major processes that take place throughout the year. One is that we have annually an external audit of all of our finances, and that's done by an outside firm. They're looking at the major elements of every institutional budget and going through, reporting back through the system, and then offering recommendations. And frankly, none of this has showed as part of that. Secondly, we have the internal audit function. It looks at process. It looks at finances. It focuses mostly on process, but that really is the key area where you're looking at kind of a consistent review assessment, and what might be found in at Oregon State University as a particular issue will now become, in a sense, it's a red flag to make sure that we have to look at that at other campuses. Part of that whole process, which Representative Smith had mentioned at the last, actually at our earlier sessions, was risk assessment. part of what we do is do a risk assessment on an internal audit function basis to determine what are the areas that are most vulnerable. What are the areas that we really have to take a look at, both financially and from the standpoint of process? And so that, and now because this has been more of an issue, that will become a concern that we'll make sure we follow up on with other campuses.
So what I hear you saying then is, at the current time, the federal fund balance issue is not part of the audit function that OUS has in place, except for at OSU?
Madam Chair, it is part of what we do, but it is not a significant high priority. When you're talking about this is a very unique program, I have to say. You're looking at the statewides, and the functions are unique to Oregon State University. Now, everybody has fund balances in their federal funds. These are really a different sort of set of funding that they're working through, and probably have a little bit more flexibility in using those dollars in conjunction with the state funds. So in a sense, what's happening with them will have little application, particularly to the regional universities, and to some degree with University of Oregon. I think that would be where the bigger red flag would be, along with Portland State, in going back and looking at their federal funds and any use of fund balances they might have. But in some sense, this is fairly unique, just given the nature of the statewide programs.
Thank you. I think that just in a general sense here, one of the things that we have discussed a lot here is that there is not a high degree of oversight in the legislative arena over the fiscal functioning of the Oregon University system. And I think that any time that issues come to the front that point out inadequacies in the auditing system, or for whatever reason, the big issue is the public's trust in the system's ability to manage its finances. And so we do take those things very seriously in the system, and we are very, very interested in the changes that are put in place to your internal controls and audits to mitigate for the issues that we all have to talk to our constituents about. So I don't think that we would be doing a fair job of the discussion on this without reiterating that the fiscal integrity and the functioning of the system and the auditing and the controls on the system are critically important as we talk about our piece of the budget here.
Madam Chair, I agree 110%. You're absolutely right, and that is an expectation you should have. At any time that there are concerns, issues, we should be able to come forward and tell you exactly what we're doing, how we're doing it, and if there is a sense of inadequacy, then we should be, you know, working toward improvement.
Madam Chair. Senator Gordon. Thank you. Given what you've said, Madam Chair, and the response, I must say that I am hearing for the first time today that the previous problem 2 years ago did not exist. And so in this public hearing, could you please say for the record what happened?
Okay. Chair Morgan and Senator Gordley, what happened was that the institution had identified a $20 million problem and had identified it and said, here's the things that we have to put in place to alleviate that problem. What was found to be the case is that probably 75% of the funding, or of the $19 million problem, was actually a computing error. There had been an error in a computation, a doubling up of a biennial from an annual number, and it was kind of suggested that is an amount now that we've got to deal with. Also, part of what they were doing was looking at their budget and saying, and almost relating it to a deficit and saying, this is what we want to do. Now, it's something that wasn't budgeted, and that became part of the discussion, and what they were looking at the time is saying, you know, we're not going to be able to do that unless we spend $150,000 or $200,000. And in reality, that wasn't a budgeted item. They didn't have to spend the money. It wasn't a mandate. But they had included it as part of a kind of an overall deficit. In the end, they probably had... And again, President White can correct me. I think there was probably in the area of $4 million which on a $200 million plus budget is what almost kind of a margin that you're going to expect on a biennial basis.
President White.
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, if I might, it's not 20 million, it was 19. Vice Chancellor, not that I'm counting. But the point is an important one, and that is that it was a projected deficit. It was one we had those errors that were just alluded to, but secondly, it was an aspiration that we wanted to invest in certain programs. And so I also would like the record to indicate that we were at no time in deficit, and our budgets were balanced in the years preceding and the years during and the years after that. We had a terrible time with our public relations during that time, and so the impressions of what was going on versus the realities were quite different. So I appreciate the opportunity today to clarify that for you.
And if I may follow up, was there an external audit that validates the conclusion that you've shared?
That's correct. There was an external audit outside of the system that was brought in by the Chancellor's Office at the request of the Board that did a fresh analysis and led to that interpretation and conclusion.
And who provided that audit?
I believe, Madam Chair, Senator Gortley, I believe it was Moss Adams.
Thank you very much.
And there is a report available if you would like one for your files.
Thank you. I would. I think we would. The committee, please.
Now, are there any other issues that the committee wishes to raise in relation to the extension service budget? With that, then, we'll move on to the remission program. Mr. Chancellor, would you wish to set the stage here?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Just a couple of words from me, and then access to a great deal of analysis and expertise on either side. The concern that we have, and forgive me for the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. The concern that we have over the issue of fee remissions is that they are indeed, the use of fee remissions is an integral process for us in the way in which we build our class, the way in which we construct the class profile, and the way in which indeed every university in the state of Oregon and every university I'm aware of in the country goes about this process. It is a process that is growing as we seek to improve the quality of our class, and it is one where we feel we have been indeed consistent with the policy directions outlined by you, the legislature, by the executive, by our own board, to produce a class that is richer in terms of diversity, that is more accessible in terms of need and access to students from less affluent backgrounds, that is richer in terms of international background, and that retains the best and brightest, so to speak, the special talents and merits of students from our state and elsewhere. So we believe that these are programs that are important and essential. They are conducted in a very objective and rigorous way. There is no element of subjectivity about them. And we would request your most serious consideration of how we can continue to build the quality of student profile that we feel is so important to our institutions on this matter. Be happy to discuss the policy issues or to answer. I know you have many questions on the details and analysis of these programs from my colleagues.
We were given a packet of information as the in part of the materials that were presented to us today, and none of us have seen this before, so it would be very helpful to be taken through this so that we know what's in it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My handoff to Lawrence Stubbett, who will start that process for us.
Excellent. Dave, do you want to?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Dave McDonald, Director of Enrollment and Student Services. This is an encore performance in terms of fee remissions before this body, and I'm glad to answer any questions that may arise, and I promise also to try to keep the speed of discussion down to a point in which you're able to digest for the first time the material, unlike the last time in which I spoke in front of you. As Chancellor Jarvis indicated, and I'll start on page 3, the fee remission serves some very core functions to how we as a university serve the students and the state. First of all, it is used to support access for students from low-income backgrounds, as well as diversity. And so, as you see, bullet number one, it is definitely an access tool for low-income students. The supplemental portion of our FEAR, which is supplemental tuition grant, was approved by our board in the 91-93 biennium in direct response to the dramatic tuition increases we had to put forward in response to Measure 5 being passed by the state. And that was really the start of our very focused effort to try to make sure that we had a need-based element to our activities. As you can see in item number D, total expenditures for our supplemental tuition increased by 23% from 01-02 to 02-03, reflecting, again, the increase in tuition, increased cost to students, and our continued commitment to serving low-income students and maintaining the door of access. Number two, we talk about...
How much did the system raise tuition over that same period of time?
It was by between 12 and 20% depending upon the campus. Realize also,
and the 12 to 20% represents the range by campus?
Correct.
Is there an average number there?
Steve, you want to respond?
Madam Chair, members, I would refer you to page 9 of this report that you're looking at. If you look at page 9, this is a summary of all 7 campuses. It contains a lot of information. You can see it's basically divided into 3 boxes. In the top box, you'll see about three quarters of the way down in that box an indication of total fee remission amounts. The fee remission that we are discussing right now is actually the first one in this list of programmatic fee remissions, the OUS Supplemental Tuition Grant. The increase, the amount in 0203 was, $5.4 million compared to the $4.4 million year before. So if you look at that rate of increase, it is approximately the 23% that was being referred to. Now, your question, Madam Chair, was about the total increase in tuitions. On the same table, if you go down to the last row of numbers, still in the top box, though, before you get to percentages, you can see the total tuition revenues. And you could compare the 0203 number of about $305 million to the 0102 number of about $277 million. And that would represent approximately a 10% increase in tuition dollars.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bender. That was just what I was after. Please proceed, Mr. McDonald.
Thank you. The second part that FEAR missions strongly support are diversity. Diversity being defined very broadly to include but not be exclusive to race and ethnicity. As you can see, our board approved the expanded diversity initiative in terms of FEAR missions in October 97, and fall 2002 we enrolled nearly 1,000 more minority students at the undergraduate level than we had the previous year. Clearly the FEAR missions were a large part in providing access and opportunity to those students. The third point, as Chancellor Jarvis indicated, was looking at special needs and merit. As a university, we have a commitment to serving the students of the state. And one of the things that the legislature has continually asked us to do is make sure that we provide ample opportunity to the state's brightest students, we call the high-achieving students. And so we have information regarding how that is addressed through the FEAR mission program, including 3 specific campus examples that reward student merit. These are incoming freshmen. It is important to note that transfer students from our community colleges are also eligible for FEAR missions based upon merit. I chose to highlight the first-time freshman one simply to keep the conversation consistent.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Just for clarity, should we understand that the diversity initiative is also inclusive of women?
That is correct, Senator Gordley. diversity, Chair Morgan, Senator Gorley, diversity is defined at the campus level to include issues such as cultural diversity, economic background, special talents, needs, and such. It is not a race or ethnicity exclusive category.
I appreciate that clarification.
Thank you.
It changes the picture of what we're looking at if we include gender.
Yes, it is a broader definition of diversity.
Yes.
Moving on to page 4, one of the issues that has surfaced has been how are peer missions actually awarded. And they are awarded through a very structured process, each campus reflecting the campus size. Larger campuses are better able to have committees because they have more people on campus with greater degrees of expertise. Our regional campuses, which are much smaller in terms of FTE, tend to have a smaller committee structure because people are doing more things and there are core functions that all campuses must provide. But we typically have...
May I just interrupt one more time? I want to go back to the diversity initiative, and I'm wondering if you can give the committee an overview of just what is involved in that. What else is there, or is there anything else? The type of students that are eligible to take part in the program, I would assume minority students, the way that they have been traditionally defined, and now you say you also have added women to the list. What else is on that list?
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, the list is not an inclusive list, but rather one that is tailored or allowed for each campus to tailor to meet its own needs. Through a history of legal actions that we've dealt with in terms of the Office of Civil Rights, which is part of the U.S. Department of Education, as well as our own direction, we have made the decision that with board approval to make sure diversity is very broadly defined. It certainly includes racial minorities, it includes women, but it may also include older than average students, students who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, which is normally beyond the normal undergraduate age range. It may include individuals who have had interesting backgrounds and cultural experiences, perhaps a student who spent 12 years, 15 years in South Africa or Africa and brings to the campus a broad set of perspectives, experiences, and things that can be shared to help enlighten the other students on the campus. It may include individuals who have special musical or artistic talents, but who may not be on a merit level of a high GPA or high SAT, but nonetheless are valuable for a campus to have in terms of forming an overall campus that reflects society and helps foster all of our students' growth. So it's a broad term. It's one that gives our campus maximum flexibility, but it certainly is very sensitive to race and gender.
Does there exist, given your statement that there is ability on a campus-by-campus basis to make an interpretation on the qualifications for it, does there exist on each campus a list that defines the categories of people who are eligible for this?
Chair Morgan, the list does exist on the campus level, and we can provide that to you.
I think the committee would be very interested in getting that list.
We'll get that criteria to you.
It's also interesting, Madam Chair, I'm looking back at the previous information shared with the committee. It's in a document dated April 29th, responses to questions raised during OUS hearings, and there's a section on fee remissions. And what was striking to me was the statement that women were more likely than men to receive a fee remission. And if you look at the data for each of the campuses, that's borne out by the numbers of females on each campus being the majority to have received the fee remission.
Senator Gordley, one of the factors that affects that is simple demographics. There are more women enrolled in the university on every one of our campuses than there are men. And until things change, that trend will actually continue to grow, where we will have more women than men enrolled.
Okay. The other thing that's striking about the display of information is that when we had the scholarship commission before us, and I believe we heard that when we asked about, when we probed for more information that would tell us how scholarships are granted by category, race, ethnicity, gender, I believe they told us they were unable to disaggregate that information. and that we had to get it from the each university. And what you're in fact providing to us is the kind of information that would be also useful for the scholarship commission to gather. But you know, I understand it doesn't happen that way. But this is helpful.
In terms of the data, it is an issue that previous conversations was also addressed, the desperate and disparate data systems that exist. Within the Scholarship Commission in OUS, we are rapidly becoming much more integrated in our ability to share data and to do joint research projects, to the point that if the Scholarship Commission were to request this type of data from us for students who have received funds to which they administer, we would be able to provide them the data they need.
Stop right there. Why don't you provide it to them?
The challenge is knowing which students exactly are they looking at, because we don't have their full roster of all the students that have received funding. We have the opportunity grant awardees, but there are other programs which they also administer.
But I'm hearing you say that it would take a request from the Scholarship Commission in order for you to provide information back to them, reflect information back to them. Well, let me back up. Is that a conversation that's taking place right now?
Senator Gordley, it is an ongoing conversation. As needs come up from either agency, we have very quick turnaround to each other. What I'm hearing you suggest strongly is that this should become a standard data sharing, and we can certainly proceed in that direction.
And I will underscore that is a strong request, yes.
So noted.
Yes. And I think that it should be inclusive of what the private institutions, what that data looks like as well. Again, if what we're after is a seamless educational system, then this data must be shared, and the data ought to be inclusive of what's happening in the private institutions.
Chair Morgan, shall I proceed?
Please proceed.
In the awarding process of fee remissions, as I indicated, these are campus-based awarding processes, typically with multi-constituent committees, with faculty members of the admissions office, financial aid office, and academic advising or multicultural affairs, depending upon the campus. Many of the fee remissions are actually very formulaic. If you refer back to number 3 on the previous page, you'll see that Eastern Oregon, Portland State University, and University of Oregon grant fee remissions automatically to students at certain high school GPA thresholds. A student meets those requirements, they are automatically given either $500 or $1,000, depending upon the campus and the program. Again, no discretion at all. That is a straight formulaic process. Others, such as the supplemental tuition fee offset grant, look at need. Again, there is no discretion involvement. That is purely a need-based decision based upon student information provided through the FAFSA form. It is important to note that for our graduate students who receive significant fee remission support, there are collective bargaining issues, and this is certainly part of their employment remuneration and is a much more complicated issue because of its involvement with collective bargaining, such as how much do they receive, the amount of tuition they receive in terms of support, health care, things of this nature. All these are part of the policy or the collective bargaining agreement. Fee remissions address the tuition side of that. The award criteria are public. They are in the admissions material. I'll put together on the diversity one per Senator Gordley's request a single document that has all 7 campuses' criteria and eligibility regarding the diversity awards. And this is something that our campuses promote quite actively in their recruitment materials as a way to encourage students to apply and understand that financing is available to support their education. And finally, the fee remission program is reviewed annually by our board and internally by our staff on a very regular basis. And number 7, there are limits in terms of the amount of funding a student may receive from a fee remission program. They are not an unlimited source of funding, either on an aggregate level or on a per student level.
We have in the spreadsheet displays that you got that you gave us holes punched over some of the information. Can I get you to take us through so we can fill in the missing information? And where I'm at here, I'm on page 9, the middle display, and we're in numbers of students here, programmatic fee remissions for Oregon Educational Diversity Initiative, and this is just a total number, but if you could give it to us, it will save some legwork here.
Okay, you're on page 9, Chair Morgan, middle box, is that correct?
Middle box, and then under programmatic fee remissions, we're missing the second and third items in the total. The Oregon Educational Diversity Initiative total number of students and the international program total number of students for 0203.
Certainly. For the Educational Diversity Initiative, the number should be 4,554.
Okay.
And for the international programs, 533.
Okay. And then moving over to page 11. Now, that one's okay on mine.
Could I, while you're looking for the next hole, could I...
So you're saying we have holes in our data. I apologize, Representative Martin.
Absolutely. Let me just clarify titles here in the boxes. Under the top box on page 9 says fee remission allocations, and then it says total graduate assistant fee remission. Is that really the total graduate assistant fee remission, or is that the total fee remissions? And then the next two box, one of them is graduate and one of them is undergraduate.
Perhaps I can answer that.
Yes.
I'm Lauren Stubbard, Assistant Vice Chancellor for the University System. On the financial summaries, we showed the general. Those are graduate assistant fee remission amounts,
okay.
Separate from the programmatic fee remissions.
Oh, okay. So that's a separate line.
That is correct.
Okay, I got it.
Provide the total context of the fee remissions.
Thanks for clarifying that. That's just.
Okay, I'm going to take you over to page 13, and in the middle box, we need the total number of graduate assistantships at fall fourth week for 0203.
That number, Chair Morgan, would be 635.
Okay, and then going down to the bottom box, there is a, in the bottom section, fourth line from the bottom, PSU/Washington Merit Program, for 0203.
That number would be 1,865.
Okay.
And is there a number above it?
Just before it.
A number above that, if your hole punch was a little off, that would be 968.
968. Okay, then I would take you over to page 15. And in the middle box, the section that is programmatic fee remissions, we need the 03 number for the OUS supplemental tuition grant.
That would be 2,147.
I'm sorry, what was that again?
2147.
2147. We have some unpunched
topics. All right.
So let's go off of these ones. And I will. Committee members, do you have any questions, or should we just proceed with the presentation?
Madam Chair,
Senator Gordon.
I would like some more information about the collective bargaining issues that impact the fee remission process for graduate students. What are those issues?
Senator Gordley, members of the committee, our graduate students, those who are employed as teaching assistants, are unionized on the campuses under the term Graduate Teaching Fellow, or GTFs. Under typical bargaining of terms and conditions of employment, certainly the tuition that they pay to be students is one of the issues that is looked at. Our students who are GTFs and covered in collective bargaining have as part of that agreement on their teaching assistantships payment of their tuition and fees. And again, that is negotiated on a campus-by-campus level in terms of additional benefits, health care, stipends, and such.
Okay.
And fortunately, depending upon your view on that, collective bargaining for graduate student assistance has grown into a national issue, so it is spreading across many U.S. campuses.
Is there a prohibition on any of the fee remission dollars being paid for union fees?
Senator Gordley, I'm not sure. I would assume that indeed there is, but we can certainly verify that. I would not want to give an answer that I'm not 100% positive of.
Okay. I'm not stating that as a problem. I'm just curious about the...
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Marks.
As I recall, I was once a graduate assistant doing research, and the tuition reimbursement was basically never seen. I mean, it was not considered as you didn't get a check for it and pass it on to the university, so there was nothing to take out from it. But if you were getting an additional stipend, then a person may, at their request, have money taken out of that.
To cover union dues?
If you request it. If you say, I'm a member of this bargaining unit and I'm a member of the union, you could request that money be, that part of your stipend that was like your pay be taken, yes, but at the individual's request.
Senator Masterly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I was called out of the committee for a bit there. But am I understanding this right, that graduate students that are teaching graduate students, and athletic scholarships are both considered in fee remissions? And those remissions or those expenditures are made up by the other students who are paying their full tuition. Is that, am I on the wrong track here?
Chair Morgan, Senator Messerly, the graduate assistant fee remission.
For the record,
Lauren Stubbard, Vice Chancellor or Assistant Vice Chancellor.
Thank you.
Assistant Vice Chancellor, Oregon University System. There are a number of forms of financial aid. You mentioned athletics, and most athletic scholarships are straight scholarships paid for by outside parties, and we have very limited there. So that is kind of a separate issue. Graduate assistant fee remissions in general are, yes, supported by student tuition. That is correct. Statutes prohibit the university system from using state appropriation for financial aid purposes directly. So historically, we have assigned these, and that's one reason why they're reflected as negative tuition revenue, to emphasize that point.
Chair Morgan, may I add a point of clarification for Senator Mesley? There have been no allocations to athletes from the fee remission program itself. So while a remission is supported by other student tuition, there is no athletic support or athlete support from this program.
Madam Chair, I ask you another question. Since it's my understanding that it's pretty much up to the specific universities on how they manage the fee remission program, and I'm looking through here, and maybe I'm just not finding it properly, but I'm interested in the total amount of fee remissions per campus. And what percentage that of those remissions compared to their total fees, I guess. And you might have got the part of it, but I don't think it was broken down per campus. Is here?
We have some of that information in here. We were not able to complete all of the answer all of the questions that were raised yesterday. We'll be continuing to work on that and provide you the additional information as we are able to get it prepared. We'll be going over some of this financial information here directly. Okay.
Please proceed.
Shall we just go ahead? If you would like to, Lauren Stubbard, Assistant Vice Chancellor, Chair Morgan, we can proceed through the financial summaries that we prepared.
I think that may give Senator Messley an idea of the
yes.
What information is actually lacking.
Yes. Just to give you a brief overview of the financial structure of fee remissions, they are in two broad categories. Graduate assistance, which, as we've discussed, are a form of compensation, and programmatic fee remissions, which are a form of financial aid. Within the programmatic fee remission category, We have two broad subdivisions, those that are annual and need-based, and we have one particular fee remission. The first one listed there, the OUS Supplemental Tuition Grant, is a need-based fee remission program for which students must apply and qualify on an annual basis to receive that. The remainder of the programmatic fee remissions listed from the Educational Diversity Initiative down through the institution-specific programs are granted on merit-based criteria or diversity or other enrollment management types of criteria. And they are normally given with the understanding that they would be a multi-year commitment to the student, normally for a five-year period. And the student must maintain qualification of the criteria during that time, but they don't need to reapply annually for that. The historical context of the management, prior to 1999, fee remissions and tuition generally were owned and managed by the Oregon University System Board. And the institutions were basically assigned allocation amounts through a variety of criteria and formulas for each institution to allocate to their students. Most all of these fee remission programs have been in place for a number of years. The supplemental tuition grant, for instance, was initiated in 1991 following implementation of Measure 5, and we were increasing tuition that biennium by 40%. And one of the conditions of that substantial increase was that a portion be set aside for need-based financial aid. And so that was the initiation of that program. Others have been added prior to that and some following that. With 1999 and the implementation of the resource allocation model, which we're all becoming familiar with, institutions were given authority to have more direct ownership and management responsibility of their tuition, of initiating tuition recommendations, being more entrepreneurial and innovative in how they managed their resources and generated their resources as well as their enrollment. At that time, the board directed the institutions that their fee remission programs should be maintained at levels comparable to those of 1998-99, which was the last year preceding the implementation of the RAM. The general interpretation of that directive by the board was that fee remissions should not fall below those ratio levels in order to sustain the fee remission program. The institutions have, and some more assertively than others, have taken initiatives in being more entrepreneurial and in doing things to enhance their enrollment growth, have initiated other fee remission programs, and we will walk through those. But that's just kind of the general context of the programmatic fee remissions and how they have gone through a period of transition. So within the last 3 to 4 years particularly, institutions have taken a much keener attention to the value of fee remissions as an enrollment management tool for attracting students and for tailoring their enrollment. It should be noted that approximately 60% of the students that receive merit-driven fee remissions also qualify for need-based financial aid. And so it's not that the merit criteria is really strictly for going to students who could otherwise afford full tuition. The information that you have in front of you, page 9 is a summary of the university system, of the 7 institutions, and the total amounts for each program. And I've divided these up, as Mr. Bender indicated, that you have 3 broad boxes. The top box in this summary is the total dollars allocated each year for these purposes, and giving you some overall historical ratios as requested yesterday compared to the level of tuition And you can see how the ratio of the fee remission programs to the tuition has generally been fairly stable, particularly with graduate assistantships, but the other fee remission programs have generally been fairly consistent with some growth here in the last 2 to 3 years. The second box in the middle of the page represent the number of recipients of these awards. Keep in mind that a particular student may be eligible and receive more than one of these awards, and so there is about a great deal of overlap, but a term called the unduplicated headcount gets in to. There are just a few students who might get more than one award, but this is the total headcount of students who would receive these awards throughout a year. Then the third box represents the annual amount, the average over the student population receiving these awards and what the average amount of those awards are. And you can see that they vary considerably depending upon the nature of the program, and something to keep in mind, one particular area, the international programs, I know, and issue of non-residency is an issue, and we'll discuss a chart at the very last page of this packet on the numbers of non-resident students who receive fee remissions. It varies by program depending upon the focus of that fee remission program. Just to provide a context in looking at the average amounts of allocation at the bottom of the page, during this historical period, tuition rates have varied from a low of $2,400 approximately in 1997-8 for resident undergraduate students up to their current levels of about $3,500 per student. And some of these programs, particularly the international program, should be pointed out. There, the resident undergraduate tuition ranges from $9,800 back in 97-8 to about $13,000 a year. So you can see just at that very high level that those students who receive these that are non-residents are still paying a fair amount of tuition into the system, even though they may be receiving. I was unable to complete the analysis on a more specific analysis of how much non-resident tuition versus the fee remissions that they might receive under these programs. So I'll get that to you as soon as I'm able. Are there any questions on the overall summary page?
Thank you. So for example, that international program you just pointed out, they're paying $5,200, and I mean they're getting a break of $5,200 on a $13,000 bill, so they're bringing in an extra $7,000 we wouldn't have had maybe.
That is correct. Yes.
But at the same time, we're seeing a drop in the number of students in the program, quite a substantial drop, and a substantial increase in the international program fee remission that they're receiving, if I'm correctly interpreting this data.
I do have to caution that estimate for 2003 is driven from preliminary numbers that we got in fall of 2002, and so I have to say that now these are estimate numbers. But yes, given the ratios that we were seeing in fall of 2002, there is a decline. There's a number of things that can contribute to that. Relative to the world situation of our international students is becoming much more complex.
I understand it's much harder to get visas for students to come into the United States. So although we may have said come be a student and approved it, they haven't been able to get a visa necessarily. Yes.
Madam Chair, Representative March, I think there's also a substantial increase in the competition for international students as many, if not all, public universities are scrambling for out-of-state students for precisely the same kind of benefits that you're seeing here. We're almost all charging larger tuition than the remissions, and so the competition for these students has grown substantially.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Chair Morgan, committee, following this are summaries or details for each institution. And I do apologize for the holes punched in the margins. I attempted to make sure the left-hand margin was wide enough for a hole punch, but I, 11:30 last night, I failed to anticipate a double-sided print job on this. And
well,
my apologies.
Well, we are non-hole punched copies, so we're in good shape.
Looking through here, you will see a variety of different patterns. Some institutions, as I said, have been more assertive in initiating institution programs and have a variety of natures, and I've attempted to just summarize those in here. Any one of these may have several different subunits within an institution of various programs going on of different sources of focus that they have. And some of them have been going on for some time. You'll notice that Oregon State University and University of Oregon particularly have had institutional programs that have gone on for several years. And then in most cases, these have accelerated within the last 2 to 3 years as institutions have begun exercising the more direct responsibility and accountability that they have been given by the board for creating an environment of attracting students to their institutions under the model. I don't know if you want to go through how much detail you want to get into on any one of these institutions. It's a lot like peeling an onion. The more you get into it, the more questions raised. But I think the overall concept to make note of is that the board programs that have been in place for a number of years have been relatively stable, and I think you can see that generally the ratios of fee remissions to tuition income have been fairly stable over time. It has only been within the last 2 to 3 years that the institutions have begun to accelerate some of their initiatives, and some fee remissions have increased as a result. And also the fact that the awards generally on average are below what the amount of tuition assessment is, and we'll be giving you more information on that.
If I might go back and ask a question about the categories of awards. Under in the verbiage in the front of the spreadsheets, there is Oregon Minority Enrollment Initiative, and there is the Oregon University System Educational Diversity Initiative and the Portland Teachers Plan. Is the Portland Teachers Plan a separate piece from the Oregon University System Educational Diversity Initiative, or is it a part of it?
Chair Morgan, it is a separate plan. It is a cooperative program that now involves Portland Community College, Portland State University, and most recently University of Portland, and it is designed to increase the number of minority teachers who get their teaching credential and then ultimately teach in Portland Public Schools, which is also the K-12 partner in this. So it is a separate program.
And the funding for the fee remission for the Portland Teacher Plan is this, it comes from the tuition that's paid by the whole body of students in the system.
As is all other fee remission programs.
Chair Morgan, that would be from the students at Portland State. I mean, each institution supports its own fee remission program.
Oh, so this is a program only at Portland
State.
That is correct. Oh, thank you for that clarification.
Madam Chair?
Senator Mazzardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to try not to put my foot in my mouth like I did last time, because you had all the information sitting here. I just haven't found it yet.
All of us have wet
feet.
But
I do have a question now that I think I see the figures. I noticed that when I look at the major universities, Portland State, Oregon State, and University of Oregon, that Portland State University has a much lower percentage of fee remissions. Is there a reason for that? I was trying to couple them up with their graduate programs and make some sense of it. But there's quite a difference in those two universities.
Yes. Chair Morgan, Senator Nesterly. Each institution has been given a fair amount of autonomy since 1999 in setting their course for fee remission programs, and that happens to be how Portland State has chosen to proceed. They've you know, in one sense, they've had a very high rate of enrollment growth. Perhaps they've not sensed the need to do other things, and they have a fairly diverse community to begin with. But it's a strictly institutional prerogative at this point as to how they would proceed.
Thank you.
And you can see that their institutional programs have not accelerated as rapidly as the other institutions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gorthy.
I think it would be helpful, given that we're looking at the Portland State example, to hear something from that institution that gives a more direct explanation for what it is we're looking at, if that's possible to do today.
Today?
Is there someone in the audience who can respond? And if not...
Chair Morgan, Senator Gorley, I don't know that we have anybody in the room right now that's okay. prepared to respond to a detailed question on their fee remission program.
All right. I guess what I'm getting at is so that we're not speculating or assuming what the case might be at a given university, let's get some factual information.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not to...
Certainly.
Diminish anything that you said, but let's get more factual information for the record so that we know exactly what we're talking about.
Yes.
And again, getting back to the issue of the Portland Teacher Plan and the Portland State University spreadsheet in this, is the Portland Teachers Plan delineated separately on the spreadsheet at all?
No. It would be reflected in the...
Diversity.
Other
it's a piece of the diversity initiative.
It would either be in there or in the Portland programs. Yes, I would have to. I believe it was part of the diversity initiative numbers.
Could I ask it?
Representative March.
Contracted programs, is that could it fall in that kind of category, or what's contracted programs?
Chair Morgan, Representative March, no. The contracted programs are made up of two categories. One, I can summarize the WICHE program, which is a Western Interstate program, and contracts and grants, which students who work, and the grant pays for
it. The grant pays for it, right. Okay, been there.
Do you have more to present to us?
Chair Morgan, just to point out two other items that had been requested staff provide. Senator Gorley yesterday asked for an update of the ethnicity data, and on page 17 and 18 are some tables that summarize that. And we show the fall of 2002 and the 01 and 2000 numbers. I think in some of these numbers, it's if you look at some of the raw growth, it would appear that white and other student categories are growing considerably, and when you look at percentage of totals of the total distribution. However, I think what's most important to focus on is that the percent of OUS undergraduate enrollment percentages are being at least maintained fairly closely by each of these ethnic groups, with the exception of other, which I presume is students have the option of how they categorize themselves, and multiracial, they choose to identify themselves as other, so there's a significant increase in the percent of undergraduate enrollment of that. Keep in mind that these are undergraduate enrollment, so they won't necessarily, you won't be able to tie these totals directly back to some of the other numbers. And then, are there any questions on that, these summaries?
Senator Gorley, what do these numbers tell you? What do you see as trends? What's your analysis?
Well, I'm a financial person, so perhaps I should defer to Mr. McDonald.
Mr. McDonald.
Senator Gorley, my read on these trends is that the fee remission programs
are doing a very good job of supporting students from diverse backgrounds, that we are having growth in diversity in terms of student backgrounds, ethnic diversity, and I would conclude that the Fear Mission program is part of that process. Certainly you can never find a one-to-one relationship of action to result in this area, but I think this is part of the success that we've realized as a system in enrolling a more diverse student body.
And within that analysis, Mr. McDonald, do you see any challenges? You painted a very positive picture, and I'm not questioning that, but there are always challenges. What are they?
Senator Gordley, there are numerous challenges. Certainly the first for students of color, as with any other low-income student, is the overall cost of attendance. While the Fear Mission program is a very good source of funding, the lack of adequate support from the Opportunity Grant, the greater reliance on loans for students continue to create additional barriers for student entry into college, especially minority students who are more likely to be from low-income backgrounds. Additional barriers are the fact that as much as we'd like to be able to grow our Fear Mission programs, there are pressures to maintain or even reduce mission programs. And whether or not those are realized, they do send an undercurrent of uncertainty regarding the program to the population we're trying to serve. And so we are having to deal with a PR issue, similar to what President White talked about in terms of the PR issue that OSU faced regarding their deficit or reported deficit.
I appreciate those comments. And I would add, Madam Chair, just a reminder, we heard, well, we actually didn't hear it from the Oregon Progress Board directly, but we've read in their reports that document the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations, that one of the most challenged populations right now with regard to access to college is the Hispanic population. And so I see the Fear Mission program and the successes that Mr. McDonald has described to us as it's an avenue for access for that particular population if you look at the numbers, which are going up. And so that tells us that we're doing something correctly to get at that underrepresented pool of students that we do want to see accessing our university system.
I concur.
Representative March.
Well, thank you. As a follow-up to that, I mean, we've in many instances enticed these students to our universities with these fee remission programs, and the expectation has been that those students are going to stay in the system for the next 4 or 5 years, say. So what do we do if the legislature was to roll this back, either prohibit it or cut it back? What happens to those students that we've enticed?
If I may, Madam Chair and Representative March, I believe we would face severe exposure for litigation in these matters. We have made multi-year commitments. That is the standard for these awards. Indeed, the students would expect these awards to be standard and not bait and switch. That's uniformly regarded as very bad policy in financial aid, and would bring a great deal of disrepute upon our system. So I think if we were to be looking at a rollback of prior commitments, we would be facing a very severe exposure, and would look to find some protection on that in any way that would happen. My greater concern, beyond the financial exposure, would be the reputation that we would be sending in a huge step backwards for a set of policies that have had essentially uniform approval and understanding both here and with all the other institutions with which we compete for these students. These are all students who would receive similar kinds of offers from every other institution that is attempting to recruit them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Chancellor, that's a very serious statement that you're making, that there could be or would be severe exposure for litigation. Are you making that statement as a result of advice from legal counsel because you have had discussions about what might happen if the legislature were to move in that policy direction?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordy, that is correct. That is the concern of our general counsel. I'd be happy to put that in written form for the committee, and believe I should.
If you would, please.
Just to follow up on that, Mr. Chancellor, so is there some kind of a written agreement when a student enters into the university that the fee remission program will continue over the life of the student's career at the university?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the need-based awards are annually qualified. So those are annual awards for which students qualify each year. All of the others are multi-year awards, and those are typically made as a multi-year award. That would be a commitment.
Mr. Bender, could you add to this conversation?
Do the commitments also indicate what the amount of the fee remission will be in each of the future years, and how are those commitments usually made?
That is correct. That is spelled out. Typically, the award is set for a certain amount, $1,000, $2,000 per year, with a minimum qualification for continued support, such as full-time enrollment and some sort of minimum college GPA, typically above a 3.0. But those are very much spelled out. Again, we don't want to put students in a position of having to guess what their future financial support will be from the institution, so we try to put all that up front from day one.
Would it be possible to make available to the members of the committee some kind of standard form agreement that takes?
We will provide some sample award letters.
Thank you. And with that, we are out of time. So I think considering that we made it only through the first two points on our agenda, we definitely will be meeting in session here tomorrow morning and continuing to discuss the issue of the vacancy savings. And so, Mr. Bender, do you have any further announcements for the committee?
No, Madam Chair. We would continue down this daily agenda list and then continue back through the work plan for the items that are beyond that.
Thank you. Then I will close the work session on House Bill 5021 and adjourn this meeting, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.
Thank you so much.